Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites, our weekly look at the food system, heard here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and La Marva Public Radio on WSDL 90.7 and WSCL 89.5 FM, our sister stations. And we are here now. We're going to take a look. In the first part of our program on Soundbites today, we're going to talk about the judge's ruling that took place. You know, we covered the what was known as the Purdue Hudson Waterkeeper trial with some intensity while it was going on, and postmortems as well. Lots of analysis on what that trial meant, which was the Waterkeeper filing against the Hudson family under the Clean Water Act, and also against Purdue, saying that they were also should be held legally responsible as well. The case was lost. A ruling has come down the case that said that the plaintiff's side does not have to pay costs, but also criticize the plaintiff's case and some of the things it said. And we're going to talk about what those mean, what the future of this case means, and with our two guests. Scott Edwards joins us once again, co-director of the Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch, and George Ritchie, trial lawyer with Gordon Feinblatt, attorneys at law, who is the attorney for the Hudson family. And Scott and George, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Morning, Mark.
Morning.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. Jump on our Facebook pages. We'll see what you got to say. 410-319-8888. So this case, somebody called me and said, this is a case that won't go away. And so let me start with you, Scott. What does this ruling mean that the plaintiffs are not held liable? Is it any significance beyond that?
I don't know that there's any significance beyond the ruling. I think what it means is that, and as the judge indicated, that it was not a frivolous case. There was a basis for the filing. There was pollution coming off of a facility. It was reaching the Pocomoke River. It was harming plaintiffs. So all of that was validated. The judge did not like the way this case was tried, didn't like the evidence, and that's why plaintiffs lost the case. But certainly in a fee request under the Clean Water Act, the standard there is whether the filing was frivolous, and this was never a frivolous case. No one can claim it was a frivolous case. It was based on a solid set of samples, which showed high, and the judge acknowledged in his decision on the fee that it was alarmingly high. I think were the words that were used, levels of pollution. This was a case that should have been brought. That needed to be brought, and hopefully it creates a dialogue down on the Eastern Shore about CAFOs, the role they play in the health of the bay, the way this industry's run, and the regulation or lack thereof of this industry. And so this was a beginning, and we hope that it spurs a lot more dialogue and a lot more efforts to try to get this industry to clean up.
George, and what does this mean if it's that the legal fees will not be on the plaintiffs?
Well, I think what it means, Mark, and I think you have to put this in the context of the specific legal standard that the judge applied here. Mr. Edwards said that the judge concluded the case wasn't frivolous. I guess technically that's true, but if you read the opinions that he wrote, both before trial, after trial, and then in connection with this motion, it's about as close as you can get to frivolous without actually finding it so. It's true that the plaintiffs will not have to pay the defendant's fees. The standard for getting fees under the Clean Water Act in any circumstance, even when it's the plaintiff seeking the fees, is incredibly high. It's a remedy that's rarely granted, in part because judges worry about what's going to happen to future cases down the road. In his opinion, Judge Nickerson noted that the Supreme Court had interpreted the act as being more protective of plaintiffs seeking fees in a Clean Water Act case, primarily because the normal circumstance in a Clean Water Act case is you have a cash-strapped, public interest group that doesn't have a lot of money going up against a very large corporate defendant. And if you hold the plaintiff responsible for fees when they lose, that's going to have a chilling effect, theoretically, on future cases. Of course, our case, at least from my client's perspective, was very different. We were not a big corporate defendant. We were the ones who were cash-strapped. The plaintiffs had the benefit of the free representation from the University of Maryland Law Clinic. But I think the fact that the judge even would even consider our fee motion, and I'm speaking as a litigator who's handled cases beyond just this one, the fact that a judge would even consider the fact that we would file a motion for fees and make the very critical comments that you reference in his opinion, in and of itself ought to be a clear message that cases without a basis, cases that shouldn't be brought, should not be brought, and if they are, the plaintiffs have the potential of having to pay fees and set the consequences of their actions.
Scott?
Yeah, I think Mr. Rich and I are going to probably always differ on this case and the level of evidence that existed. I don't think anybody can deny that there was pollution and a significant pollution problem with this facility, and we all know the significance of the pollution problems in the Chesapeake Bay, and we all know that CAFOs are significant contributors to that problem. This is not a case about going after a farmer. This was a case about going after a polluter, and in this case, the polluters happen to be both, from the plaintiff's perspective, the everybody who owns and operates a CAFO that's polluting, and that included Mr. Hudson and Purdue Farms, and that was our belief, that was our theory, that's what we brought to the court. The court acknowledged the pollution, but said that the plaintiffs didn't establish their burden of showing that the chicken houses caused it. So, again, we're going to disagree over that level of proof and what indeed the evidence supported. We could sit on this phone probably for our entire time and relitigate this case. It's not going to change the outcome. The judge certainly had his opinion about the merits of this case. He didn't like this case. We disagree with several rulings during litigation about the admissibility of expert evidence and the use of again, we can go back and forth all day on this. We think it was a good case. We would bring CAFO cases again when we find polluters. This is not about going after farmers. This is about going after people who pollute waterways. And that's what the Clean Water Act enables citizens who care about their waterways to do. In terms of deep pockets, I no longer work for the plaintiffs. Excuse me, haven't worked there for a little bit now. But nonprofits in this country are certainly not deep pockets, not when you compare them to a company like Purdue that has over $4 billion a year in sales. Purdue is the deep pockets in this story. I understand that the Hudsons are not wealthy, but they certainly had a pollution problem, and they needed to clean it up.
So I wonder, when this case, people follow this case very closely, and I wonder about the aftermath of this case and what it brings. George, I know this is not a political realm for you, but it does the whole question of who's responsible for pollution going into our waterways was the underpinning of this case, really, in many ways.
Right.
The Hudsons were caught up in because of what was said came off their farm. So that there was a political significance to this case.
Well, Mark, I assume you're asking me this, George.
Yeah.
Look, the state has a very complex set of regulations that Mr. Edwards is aware of, the water keepers are aware of, that govern how farmers treat their manure coming off their farms. Alan and Kristen Hudson are independent contractors. They're not employees of Purdue. They're not controlled by Purdue. So they control their own manure. The reality is that most farmers in the state use some or all of their manure to fertilize their land so they can grow crops. It's a responsible practice. It cuts down on the use of chemical fertilizers down the road. So if there is a problem, if the water keepers have a problem with the state regulations, they ought to take that up with the state. However, and Scott had mentioned pollution problems coming off the farm. The reality is that Alan complies with the state regulations. He's never been cited by the Maryland Department of Agriculture or Maryland Department of Environment for pollution problems. And as we know in this case, the regulators actually came out to the farm after there were reported complaints by the water keepers of what they said was an uncovered pile of chicken manure. It turned out not to be true. But Department of Ag, Department of Environment came out, looked at the issue and said there's no problem here. So if there's a political issue with respect to this case, I think it's how do we get the farmers the help they need, whether from legal representation or regulatory and scientific advice, to help them continue to comply with the plans the states puts in place and the regulations the EPA would put in place as well. And I got to be honest, this is just from a personal standpoint, using money, using the University of Maryland Environmental Law Clinic's resources to sue farmers like Alan and Kristen is an incredibly counterproductive way to go about this. If they want to do something positive, take that money, take those resources, meet with the farmers, and see what they're doing and see how they can work to help the farmers continue to comply. And, even Judge Nickerson says in his opinion, having gone through all the facts with respect to the fee motion, that the saddest thing about this case is that nothing that could have benefited Chesapeake Bay actually came out of it. And there are a lot of reasons for that. He cited the plaintiff's conduct during settlement, some of their legal theories. But the bottom line is that if there's a political message, it's got to be working with the farmers, not suing them into the ground.
Scott?
Yeah, I think that Mr. Ritchie does point to a valid issue. There is a political problem in the state, and there is a proper lack of regulation. Complying with bad regulations doesn't necessarily let you off of the Clean Water Act. The Clean Water Act is a liability statute that doesn't allow you to pollute. But there are significant problems with regulating this industry in the state. And every time the state tries to better its regulation of this industry gets up and makes a lot of noise. And I think we just saw that last week with new phosphorus regulations. It's not fair to say that this industry is doing all it can, and Mr. Hudson was doing all he can to not pollute, when this industry remains the largest in Maryland, the largest source of phosphorus into the bay, and its phosphorus is one of the main pollutants that's killing the bay. Ag remains the largest source of pollution, not in just the Chesapeake Bay, but in waterways across the country, and in those counties down on the Eastern Shore, where the chicken industry is most active, those soils are so phosphorus saturated that the land can't take any more chicken manure. And so here comes a reasonable regulation from the Maryland Department of Agriculture that they wanted to implement on an emergency basis, because the health of the bay is in crisis. It does require emergency relief. And here it gets sunk because of the farm community, the chicken community, rising up and saying, we won't accept this. So there's not this degree of reasonable approach here. There's a pollution problem. It's not getting any better. You can't keep dumping phosphorus-rich chicken manure onto land that can't hold any more phosphorus. It's that simple. And unfortunately, this case didn't have the good outcome it could have had because of the ruling in the case itself, not in the fee petition, but in the case itself. And that ruling would have held these big industries, the Purdue's and the Tyson's, responsible for their mess. And that's what needs to happen here. One place where Mr. Ritchie and I might agree on is that these farmers are in lots of, these contract growers like Mr. Hudson are victimized often. And Mr. Ritchie may think we're victimizing Mr. Hudson. We think Purdue's victimizing Mr. Hudson. We last year in 2012, the Maryland legislature passed a $60 per household flush tax on all Maryland residents. Since 2004, the people of the state of Maryland, the households of the state of Maryland, have put $501 million into the Bay Restoration Fund to help clean up the mess that they create through their sewer systems and to deal with their waste treatment. $501 million. In that time, these chicken companies, who are the biggest polluters, have paid nothing into Bay Restoration Fund, zero. In fact, Purdue, since 2008, has gotten over $4 million in grants and payments from taxpayers' dollars to continue their practices. So there is a huge amount of inequity here, and what needs to happen is these big chicken companies need to step up and do their fair share and take on the responsibility for the mess that they're creating like every other industry in this country.
Mark, can I just respond to a couple points?
Sure, please do, George.
Yeah, first of all, I mean, here we are. We're almost a year from when the trial actually happened in October of 2012. We're about 9 months past when the judge's ruling came out. I find it sad and disappointing that Mr. Edwards continues to call the agricultural community unreasonable. You know, after the verdict came down, there were some statements by the water keepers to the effect of, well, why can't we just work with the farmers? Let's get together. Let's work on this problem. And yet the rhetoric coming out of at least this group is completely to the contrary. I don't think that all the environmental groups in the state think it's a good practice in terms of trying to work on environmental problems to sue farmers like Alan and Kristen Hudson, and I hope that's not the case. But this group, for some reason, has it out for them. They want to punish them. And in fact, in the closing arguments in this case, Jane Barrett, who is the lead trial lawyer for the waterkeeper, said that the Hudsons had to pay for their relationship, their association with Purdue. So that is the victimization that my clients felt like, that they were being singled out because they had the temerity, how dare them grow chickens for a company like Purdue, how dare they put food on their family's table and pay their bills that way. So, you know, the rhetoric, Mr. Edwards, his group, they're very good at public relations. They're very good at messaging what they think is a very interesting and telling message to the public. What they're not good at and what they didn't do in this case is they didn't actually prove what they said they were going to prove. Mr. Edwards said, well, the farms are the biggest source of phosphorus going into the bay. And in fact, Mr. Hudson has a pollution problem and thereby a phosphorus problem. They didn't prove that. They didn't link any of the pollutants, if there were any, with Mr. Hudson's poultry operation. The only other thing I would say is there's some larger discussions that ought to happen here. Within the last year, there was a study by the University of Delaware that concluded that, in fact, maybe the EPA and some other scientists have grossly overestimated the amount of pollutants going into the bay from poultry farms. That study is currently under review by the EPA, and if it comes out that it turns out that that evidence is credible and true, that may impact regulation, and it may impact a lot of people's views as to what the agricultural community is doing with respect to the waterways as opposed to other things, urban areas and other sources.
Let me go to the phones here, and before you come back, Scott, we have a couple more questions here that came out of this that I think that need to be raised as well. 410-319-8888 here on Soundbites and the Mark Steiner Show as we take this perhaps one final look at the latest out of the Purdue Hudson Waterkeeper case. 410-319-8888. Jahari, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air. Could you turn down your radio, Sue?
Yeah, I have it off. Mm-hmm.
Cool. Go ahead, Jahari. You're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello, Mark. How are you and everyone?
Very well.
Good. Yes, I just wanted to piggyback on what was said about the farmers being the victims of these mega corporations. I saw Food Inc. and I've seen a lot of other documentaries, thank goodness for people exposing what's really going on behind the scenes. And, you know, the thing is the mainstream media don't report the things. Like, we have Mary Pert, Maryland Public Interest Resource Group, and public interest groups that are gathering the information, and the watchdogs for us, and we don't get that information. You know, the general public doesn't get that information. One last thing, things like Monsanto, you know, the Monsanto Protection Act and these types of things, I don't know what we can do as citizens. That's a question. What can we do as citizens to help expose them? There are a lot of us that already hear about what they're doing, the atrocities that they're doing, but we need something, some kind of mechanism where we can legally do something against them, the things that they're doing.
So, Scott, you want to jump in on that? Did you hear the caller?
It's a very important point, and it's all about corporate responsibility. And these big companies, and Purdue's not alone, it's the Purdue, Tyson, Smithfields, are really running the show with meat production in this country. And again, Mr. Ritchie points out that there's new studies about the impacts of the chicken industry on the Bay. And we'll wait for those studies to come out. And I can guarantee you that no matter what these new studies say, that it is still a problem with this industry, the pollution and their treatment of contract growers. This is couched. This has been couched by the defendants here as an attack on farming. This is not an attack on farming any more than if a police officer pulls over somebody for drunk driving and they happen to be a farmer, that the police department's picking on farming. We don't go after farmers. We go after polluters. And this court absolutely found pollution, a pollution problem on this farm, as did MDE. Mr. Ritchie says MDE and MDA went out there and didn't find a problem and walked away. And those folks are the regulators. But that's not true. They went out to that farm and they did find pollution problems on that farm. They did find significantly high levels of pollution on that farm. And then they walked away. And that's the problem. But in terms of what you can do to help, we help, just more evidence that we're not anti-farmers. We help farmers all the time. We help contract growers all the time. Just last year, I helped a farm family in Arkansas, a Tyson grower who was being pushed out of its home because of foreclosures, because Tyson just cut off their contract without notice. And so you can help independent farmers through purchasing their products, but you can also work and insist that your legislators and your politicians start to create an equal and level playing field for this industry. And one thing you can do in Maryland is to demand, just as I was going over before about how it's the households and the citizens of Maryland have to pay for Bay restoration. Purdue's get rich because they don't have to clean up their mess. And so one thing you can do is insist that Purdue needs to be responsible for the mess that it creates on the farms that it controls, like the Hudson Farm. And so we're going to be pushing that issue, Food and Water Watch, as we move into the fall. And you can just keep an eye out for our efforts and try to support some reasonable, responsible regulation of this industry and accountability for these industries.
Now, George, that was at the heart of this trial. So, I mean, this is, even though this court case is over, for all intents and purposes, this is a continuing issue. And I suppose agriculture and pollution is not your bailiwick, George, but
I'm learning more about it every day, Mark.
So I'm curious. One of the things that I was going to ask Scott, because it came up here in emails we've gotten from other people, and one of them was that an email we got in asking the question about the judge criticizing you personally,
right?
In this case, implying the case was lost. I'll read what it says here. That Scott Edwards implying that the case was lost because plaintiff was not given access to the Hudson Farm, as well as other misrepresentations were made by Edwards regarding the facts and law relating to the case. As counsel of record, Mr. Edwards should have been aware of the plaintiff was given access to the Hudson Farm on two occasions, and that it requested access and the plaintiff never sought permission to do any further testing. He's also aware that access could have readily been ordered by the court, but such a request was denied by Hudson.
Right. Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's a nice opportunity for me to set the record straight here. Those words never came out of my mouth. They were citing an interview I did on your show.
That's what I thought. That's whenever he was on this show, yes.
Right. And my exact words, and I have them here, is we were talking about this industry. I was talking about coal-fired power plants and wastewater treatment plants, and talking about the difference between litigating CAFOs, and I said, and here are my words, it's a burden that doesn't exist in any other Clean Water Act case, and since you don't have access to farms, you never know what's going on, you don't know what the activities are, it makes it very difficult to bring these kinds of things. To bring. I'm talking about when you're preparing a case and you're preparing to bring a case, you don't have access to farms. You don't have access to data. I was very specific in that statement. Where you go and bring, when you go to bring a case against a coal-fired power plant, as we're doing in Maryland right now for discharges of phosphorus and nitrogen, I can get monitoring records. I can get all kinds of data. I can get all of the samples that they are required, that the industry is required to do and submit to the public. I have open access to all of those things. I was very clear about when we are preparing these cases. But as with many other instances in this case, the defendants twisted that around. They walked into court. The irony is they completely misrepresented what I said in your interview. As a matter of fact, earlier on in that interview, and I don't think it made it to the, because you edited some of that out, you asked me about sampling on that farm, and you asked me why we didn't do more sampling, as the judge indicated. And my answer was, we had the samples we needed. In our opinion, in our expert's opinion, we had the samples we needed. I never said we were not allowed on the Hudson farm. We went to the Hudson farm with our expert, and in any case, and defense attorneys know this, in any case, you can ask a judge to give you permission. That was specifically done, as the defendants did throughout this trial, to try to paint the plaintiffs in a light that was completely inappropriate, unprofessional, and something that the judge bought into, unfortunately. But he bought into a lot of what the defendants tried to do here. They brought in new expert testimony in the middle of trial when they had no right to. They used lay witnesses for expert testimony, as they had no right to do. They painted Kathy Phillips as a villain. It was just part of the pattern of practice. And again, we can relitigate the case. That's not going to get us anywhere. But I'll let Mr. Ritchie have his response.
Let me just jump in. We have to take a very brief break. Really brief, and come right back.
I'd like to respond.
You will, absolutely. We'll come right back to you as soon as we have to take a legal ID break. We'll come right back here to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites as we are talking about the aftermath of the Purdue Hudson Waterkeeper case. Stay with us. This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back to Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM and on Marva Public Radio. We are here with Scott Edwards, co-director of the Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch, and George Ritchie, trial lawyer with Gordon Feinblatt, attorney for the Hudson family, as we look at what should be the last of the rulings by the Judge Nickerson in the case of Purdue, the Hudson family, and the waterkeepers. 410-319-8888 is the number here. George, please. Sorry we had to go to break before you had a chance to respond.
Thanks, Mark. And I should say at the outset that I'm glad to hear Mr. Edwards walking his statements back from what he made in December to you. But it's really important that I put this into context for your listeners, because I'm afraid that they can come away with a wrong impression about how this case was litigated and how the judge made a decision, if I don't. Bear in mind that last December we had the judge's ruling. He completely and utterly rejected the plaintiff's arguments that there was pollution from coming off from Mr. Hudson's poultry operations, and also rejected plaintiff's theory that Purdue was somehow responsible for that pollution. The judge went so far to say in his opinion that the plaintiff hadn't acted responsibly in pursuing the case, and pointed to the plaintiff's lack of testing. And just so your listeners understand, the plaintiff's theory at trial had been that pollutions or pollutants were coming off of the exhaust fans of Mr. Hudson's chicken farms and getting into the waterways, yet plaintiffs never tested any of the dust, any of the material coming out of those fans, and the judge found that, in his words, incredible. Now, you asked Scott in December whether the case maybe in retrospect wasn't as stronger as you may have thought and the waterkeepers had thought it was at the beginning. And what he said, and I encourage you, Mark, to put the transcript on your website, because it's clear as day, he said that when you're litigating against CAFOs, and Mr. Hudson's farm, by the way, is a CAFO, is a large concentrated animal feeding operation, quote, you don't have access to the farms. He also said that in litigating against CAFOs like Mr. Hudson, courts are increasingly putting extra burdens on plaintiffs to prove their case. These are very dangerous, in my view, and irresponsible statements, because they call into question the legitimacy of the court's ruling in this case. Mr. Edwards now is admitting to you and me, and I'm glad to hear it, In fact, every time his client had wanted access to the farm, he asked us for it, and we gave it to him. There was never a time when we denied anyone access to the farm. They didn't ask for the testing that the judge said they should have, but had they done so, we would have certainly let them do it. And if for some reason we hadn't, the judge could have ruled in their favor. But to suggest that they didn't have access to this CAFO when they were litigating, and to suggest that that's the reason why they lost the case, paints a portrait that these farmers, like Mr. Hudson, are operating in secret, and the law is powerless to get behind the veiled curtain and understand what's going on back here. And that's simply not the case. This was complete, open and shut. If they wanted to go in, they could look at it. There was no one stopping them. And in fact, even before trial, we asked Judge Nickerson if he would come down and look at the farm himself as part of the trial process to understand the operations of the farm, the layout. And the plaintiffs opposed that. They didn't want the judge to actually go down to the farm and take a look. The second part of Mr. Edwards' statement is that somehow courts are increasing the burden on plaintiffs to prove their case. Well, the burden of proof has remained the same under the Clean Water Act in the last 40 years since the law was enacted. So I think it's important for your listeners to understand that this judge did not increase the burdens on the plaintiffs. They had the same burden they knew they had when they filed the lawsuit and had full access to the farm. There was no secrecy, and nothing in this system is rigged in any way against plaintiffs like the water keepers.
So I wonder, you know, for
Mark, can I just respond very quickly?
Sure. Then we have about three minutes left here. Go ahead.
We need more time. there's no walking back here. The only walking back is defense lawyers who originally said that I stated we didn't have access to the Hudson farm. Now it's I suggested we didn't have access to the Hudson farm. There was not even a suggestion. My words were clear. The word Hudson doesn't come up and again, I also encourage you to put it up on your website. Nowhere does a discussion of the Hudson farm come up. I was talking about, and clearly, to bring these kinds of cases, CAFO cases, you don't. If you go on there and take samples, you are accused of trespassing, rightfully so. It's private property. It was clear. And again, we can go back and forth, but this is another example of how defendants try to demonize people. And they did it very successfully in this case. You know, they went in the court and they ranted and they raved and they called everybody who disagreed with them a liar and pounded their fists. And this is what they got. In terms of a burden, there is an extra burden on CAFOs. If I go to a coal-fired power plant, I don't have to show the broken piece of machinery. I have discharges in violation of the permit. The case is done. It's over. It's a summary judgment. On CAFOs, you've got to go up in there, and you've got to find out where the broken machinery is. That's the increase. That's the burden on litigating against CAFOs that doesn't exist in other facilities and other point sources. And I stand by those statements.
Mark, I would just say the document speaks for itself. If your listeners are interested, why don't we put the transcript up?
Sure.
Well, we'll probably do that. And if we need to continue this conversation further, we will.
I think we're going to need to.
So I want to thank both of you for taking your time today with listeners here on Soundbites here on the Mark Steiner Show. It's an important case, and we'll keep following it and all the issues surrounding it that go on politically around this. George Ritchie, trial lawyer Gordon Feinblatt, is attorney for the Hudson family. Scott Edwards, now co-director of the Food and Water Watch Justice Project at Food and Water Watch. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for being part of the show today.
Thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you, Mark.
And look at that transcript. I think we can get that up in the air. People can see that on tomorrow. We'll figure out how to get that on our website here soon to you all. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back from this break, we're going to be joined by Tom Philpott, a Mother Jones food and ag blogger, co-founder of Maverick Farms, North Carolina. Bill Mason, who we visited before on the shore here, conventional organic farmer at Mason's Heritage Farm in Queen Anne's County. As we look at no-tilling, is it good? Is it bad? What's that mean for the future of farming? Stay with us. We'll be right back with all that. On our way to this break, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA and on Marvel Public Radio. We are to take switch gears here in this conversation. Tom Philpott, who's comes on the show fairly regularly, food and ag blogger at Mother Jones, wrote an article for Mother Jones in this last issue called Talk Dirt to Me. Does David Brandt hold the secret for turning industrial agriculture from global warming problem to a carbon solution? It's all about no-till farming, which is very controversial in some levels. And we're also here with Bill Mason, whose farm we visited, and where we had conversations about no-till farming. He's a conventional and organic grain farmer at Mason's Heritage Farm in Queen Anne's County, Maryland. And Tom and Bill, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Nice to be here, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Good to have you again, Bill. It's been a while. Hope things are well.
Yes, it has.
So, Tom, let me start with you. This is you interviewed this one farmer out in Iowa for much of this article, David Brandt. So, talk about kind of the overall approach you took here, and I'm going to ask Bill to comment about this whole piece because his experience with no-till is interesting as well, and how that feeds into all this. First of all, let's define no-till farming as opposed to tilling.
Well, you know, first of all, no-till farming is just what it sounds like. For a long time, you know, hundreds, thousands of years, farmers have created a seed bed in the spring by tilling their land, running a tiller through their land, and it sort of kills weeds that are there, and it exposes, it sort of turns up the soil and makes it really easy to drop in seeds and cover them over. But what I want to say about this article is that, first of all, what works in one area doesn't work in every area. So I don't want to make any blanket statements based on this piece. This is a farmer farming in the Midwest, in the middle of corn country in Ohio. And his brand of no-till is different from the other kinds of no-till that are happening in his area, in that he never tills. He had not tilled since 1971. And a lot of his neighbors and a lot of people in the Midwest, they will use Roundup Ready to genetically modify variety of corn or soy, and use that as their weed control strategy, and not till for maybe three, 4 years, and then they'll till after that. And a lot of the benefits of no-till are lost in that system. This farmer here, this David Brandt fellow, he's not tilling at all. And there's a second component to his system that's really important, and that is that he grows what we call off-season cover crops. That is, when the cash crop is harvested, he plants in these cover crops that cover his land, you know, in the off-season and sprout out weeds and really sort of lessen the bank of seeds that are for weed seeds that are in the soil. He then kills that cover crop usually by rolling it over, taking a contraption, you know, a large machine, and rolling it over and killing it that way. And then he plants his cash crop, drills it in directly under this mat of dead organic matter. And this system it confers all kinds of benefits we can talk about, but I should emphasize that, you know, every area has its own appropriate form of agriculture. So I'm not making a blanket statement about farming in the Delmarva region, for example.
Right. So so Bill, this is interesting because, I mean, there's been so much debate around this whole question of no-till, whether it's good for the environment, bad for the environment, what it does ultimately, the idea that people have to use a lot of herbicides to get it done right. So, and you've had – talk about your experience.
Well, we have been no-tilling for quite a few years ourselves, probably since the 70s. We started no-till farming, and then we continued that to the about 2005, and then we started farming organically, and in that case, we had to start working the soil. We have experimented with no-till organic farming ever since we started, and we're still no-tilling some of our organic ground. We are plowing part of it, but we are interested in doing more no-till. We are using using cover crops on all our acres. But our experience basically has been no-tilling soybeans into rye that is planted the previous fall. And that has worked pretty well for us for 5 or 6 years. This year, we did hit a glitch, though, because we got our cover crop in late last fall, and we did not get the growth on it that we anticipated, and therefore, because we didn't have the growth on it, we didn't have the biomass that we needed to control weeds, so we did not roll any rye down and plant no-till this year. We ended up plowing most all of our organic ground. But we have been, I can just tell you this, last week we were over to USDA in Beltsville, Maryland, and they are also working on no-till organic production, soybeans, but they are also experimenting trying to do corn, and we're interested in that also. And they've had some pretty good results out there using cover crops planted the previous fall, mostly vetch and rye combination, and rolling it down in May, late May, and planting no-till corn in it.
So here's the question I think that I'm curious about, and people keep hearing this debate go on between in around farms over till, no-till. Because one of the subtitles of your article, Tom Philpott, is that is this a secret to turning industrial agriculture from global warming to the carbon solution? And given that most people who do no-till are not organic but conventional, and they do use a lot of herbicides and pesticides, you know, in no-till, how is that a step up?
Let me just say that this particular character I'm talking about, David Brandt, he's doing it differently than most folks. He's not organic, and he, you know, I think that he maybe forges a path. He's not the only one. This isn't just one guy doing this. There are several kind of spread across the Midwest that are doing this. They're using these agrochemicals as tools, as sort of emergency tools, like a healthy person might use medicine. You know, if you're a healthy person, you don't need to take medicine every day. But you're glad, you're happy that it exists, and if you get sick, you can take, you know, whatever it is. And he's using chemicals like that. And I've talked to USDA people in this area and people at the Ohio State Extension in this area. And they confirm that he uses about something like 20% of the herbicide of his peers, similarly low percentages of inorganic fertilizers. His peers. Most of his fertility comes, most of his nitrogen comes from nitrogen fixing cover crops. And so what he's doing is very, very different from what your conventional no-till farmer is doing in that area, which, as I said, they are relying on chemicals for weed control completely. They're not using cover crops, and they're tilling every few years as it becomes convenient. And, so, you know, the thing about no-till is that, you know, first of all, if you do it like Brandt does it, what you're doing is you're seeing your soil as this ecosystem, as this vibrant, alive ecosystem full of microbiota that are doing things like making fertilizers. They're making, you know, substances like nitrogen, phosphorus available to plants, and they are breaking down organic matter into humus. Sorry, and doing things like that, and running the tiller over these ecosystems just completely disrupts them. And you know, it's sort of like you know, it's a definite analogy to microbiota and the way we disturb them with things like antibiotics and not the amount of balance. Things like tillage, especially consistent every year tillage, do that to these ecosystems. And so he's creating this incredible bank of soil that is sequestering carbon. When he grows these cover crops and they die in his field, they eventually get incorporated into his soil as humus, which is holding in carbon. And, you know, like I point out in the piece, Pigeon is very heavily farmed, and it's not uncommon at all to have soil there that is 1% organic matter or less than 1% organic matter. And his soils are 4, 5, 6, up to 7% organic matter. So he's
sequestering
many, many times the carbon as it appears. And that, you know, as I put it in the piece, that really helps in drought years, because carbon-rich soils absorb water and hold it in, and carbon-poor soils expel water. Water can't penetrate them. They become fine kind of powder and end up getting washed away in a flood, and they don't hold water during the rain. When drought comes, his neighbors were getting about half their usual yield in 2012. And some of them lost their crops completely. Grain was getting 90% of its usual yield because the soil was in such good shape for the drought.
So, Tom, we're going to try to stop for a second and give you a call back on the phone. There was getting a little disruption on your Skype. So hold on a second. But let me come back to Bill. So, Bill, I mean, where does this fit into you? I mean, I know you read the article, and I know
you read the article. It's very interesting, and so, I do think he's going down the right road. I can tell you this: farmers in our area are planting more cover crops all the time, it seems like. There's great interest in it. I think we have planted cover crops for years on this farm. We've grown commercial vegetables for years. We've always planted cover crops following them. Now almost every acre on this farm has cover crops on it. Now we have 600 acres tillable here, and we plant cover crops on all of it. We also run a couple farms which we plant cover crops on. And even though we do till some of the soil, the cover crops are very beneficial. But back to your original statement, all the no-tilling chemicals, I think, that's one reason we are starting to farm more ground organically. We think that, that there's got to, that's got to slow down, because we are putting a lot of chemicals and fertilizer into the soil. I think a lot of it, which is not needed, but the use of cover crops, as I think the man's name is Mr. Grant, is finding out that when you use the right cover crops and mixtures of cover crops, you can cut down immensely on your chemical and fertilizer usage. And we're doing the same thing farming organically. Even though we're tilling part of the soil, we are putting very little nutrients on the soil. We're using no chemicals, and we're growing decent crops. And it's worked out pretty well for us.
So I'm curious very quickly, and we have about 5 minutes left in our segment here, maybe actually less than that, about 3 minutes left. And very quickly, Bill and then Tom, is the future of this in terms of both carbon sequestration and in terms of farming, is it till or no-till, or is this does it really make a difference? Bill?
Well, I think it's going to make a difference. I mean, I think... I probably have a little different perspective being an organic farmer. We've heard for years we got to produce more food. We got to feed the world, and the bigger chemical companies and fertilizer companies are pushing this stuff, I think, on us. Stacked corn with 5 different traits, and you got to use more chemicals and fungicides and all that. And I'm being an organic farmer, I think that's fine if that's what they want to do, but I'm looking at it from perspective. We need to take care of soil better, use the cover crops, and as Mr. Grant says, we got to build a better living soil there to support the crops, and it will support the crops very well, and especially in drought years, it seems to help, and that's what we're interested in. And I think more farmers are realizing in their area, the larger conventional farmers are realizing even they're planting cover crops. They're seeing benefits to cover crops. And we got to be more educated about the soil as a living body. And I think that's one thing that for years conventional farmers, including myself, have never thought about. We just poured on more fertilizer, more chemicals, and it seemed to grow a little bit more corn, and everybody was happy. But we're going to have to take care of the soil. I think we've strained it already, and we need to build it back up.
And closing out here, Tom Philpott, we've got literally about a minute and a half left. Your closing thought on this?
Well, yeah, I would say that I would agree with all that and just say that in terms of the fact that we're moving into an era of climate change, the planet's getting warmer, there's more extreme weather events like droughts and floods, a kind of farming that can sequester carbon in the soil and help mitigate a little bit this climate change problem, and also make farmland more resilient to these shocks, whether it's floods
or droughts is going to be the way to go. And I think for a large part of the country, a combination of minimal or no tillage plus off-season cover crops is going to be vital. And, I, you know, unfortunately, our policy isn't pushing us in that direction. But farmers like the man on the phone right now and like David Brandt are showing the way forward. And I do believe that is, you know, the only way, seeing the soil as a living organism that can both store carbon and stop the problem of and make our farming more resilient.
Tom Philpott, Mother Jones food and ag blogger, who wrote the article we were talking about today, Dirt Talk to Me. I'm Bill Mason, conventional organic grain farmer at Mason's Heritage Farm in Queen Anne's County, Maryland. Tom and Bill, thanks so much for being with us today.
Nice talking
thanks
to you.
Thanks for having me.
Been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you all. And thank you all for joining us here on the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community here in Baltimore, and Delmarva Public Radio, bringing you Soundbites every week at 90.7 FM and 89.5 FM. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Marvronis. Our engineer here at WEAA is Andre Melton. Our engineer at Public Radio Delmarva is Christopher Rank. To hear this show again, podcast our other shows, find information about our guests and the articles they've been writing, please visit us at our website at steinershow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM and WSDL 90.7 FM and WSCL 89.5 FM, Delmarva Public Radio, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.